This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees. Well, good evening. It's Wednesday, the 5th of February. I'm Alec Hogg, and we've got a lot of focus on expropriation without compensation. The bill that was signed into law by Cyril Ramaphosa 2 weeks ago and has seen a reaction internally and externally. We'll have a little later in the program a veteran of the Zimbabwean land grab taking us through exactly what happened in that country and worryingly why the EWC in South Africa reminds him of a 1992 law that was passed in Zimbabwe, which set the stage for the disaster that continued. But we start off with Corne Mulder. Now, you would have heard that there was quite a lot of controversy recently over the Government of National Unity, allegations that the Democratic Alliance has really become just a party which supports the ANC's ambitions. The ANC's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, signing into law a couple of bills already, and we've got a really bad one coming as far as, rational thinkers are concerned, in the National Health Insurance, which could be the make or break for the GNU. As far as Corne Mulder is concerned, and he is the parliamentary leader of the Freedom Front Plus, a member of the Government of National Unity, he reckons that the GNU is in jeopardy already. It was a fascinating interview with a man who could be playing a bigger role. The Freedom Front Plus has a leadership election on the 22nd of February, in other words, just a couple of weeks ahead. But let's listen in on some of the highlights of the interview that we had today, and the full interview is on BizNews TV on YouTube.
When the Government of National Unity was founded originally, it was the right thing at that stage. But I'm very concerned about coalitions in general, and the Government of National Unity is just one of them. Because the whole notion of a coalition or a government of national unity is that the parties involved are prepared to make compromises and to move from their own hard positions to find common ground. And that's what it's supposed to be, and that could have made a huge difference, and it sent very positive signals to investors, to South Africans, to companies, to the whole private sector, and everybody, everywhere in the world. However, since then, as far as I'm concerned, it became clear that parties are not prepared to make those compromises. And the ANC is going on as if it is still in full power all by themselves, pushing through. And I think they tested the other parties in the Government of National Unity. They started with Bella. They wanted to see what the response would be. And once it became clear to them that parties do not intend to leave because of that, they followed it up with expropriation. So my concern is at the moment, the Government of Unity, as far as I'm concerned, is in jeopardy because it seems that the parties involved are trying to outwit each other and think that they can then at the next election do so well on their own, we won't need a coalition or a government of national unity come around next time. Now, that is a problem. And the reality of the matter is, and I understand that from the Freedom Front Plus's point of view, and that would be my view. If the FF Plus does not necessarily leave or do leave from a government of national unity, it may not have a direct effect on the functioning of the government itself, but it will have a huge effect on the electorate and our support base, who will see what we are doing and why we are doing, and it may have further ramifications for other parties to remain within the Government of National Unity, implementing Bella, implementing the Expropriation Act.
There's a State of the Nation this week. There's the budget coming up on the 19th, which could also have problems. The DA has already said, if you're going to bail out Transnet, we're history, or at least they've proposed that. It might not be the case, but that's the suggestion. Then you've got your leadership conference in the Freedom Front Plus on the 22nd of this month. And of course, there's pressure coming from the United States as well. So paint us a scenario of how it could work out.
Let me say, the fact that President Trump is now the president of the United States and the free world, is that's the reality. That's absolute reality. And what he's going to do in the next 4 years, he's going to change the outlook internationally to a very large extent. Rein in China, put pressure on Russia and Putin, North Korea, all those things will happen. I've got no doubt. There's one concern that I have, and I don't know if I even can say that. The United States are so divided and so split in terms of absolutely hard positions. We've seen two attempts on President Trump's life before the election, and I am really concerned. I don't hope we get into a situation where we have a repetition of things that has happened in the past. But even if that happens, and God forbid, the Democratic Party in America is in a very difficult position, and with J.D. Vance and other people there, it seems Republicans will be doing their thing most likely for the next 12 years. People must take a long-term view, because after President Trump concludes his term of 4 years, the Republicans are very likely to take the White House again, and J.D. Vance is most likely will be the guy for two terms. So we are talking maybe of a 12-year period, which gives an opportunity, as far as I'm concerned, for South Africa, because it will bring stability, especially the approach from the United States of Mr. Trump, who will not want to get involved in conflicts and wars, etc. That's wonderful in terms of bringing peace and stability in the world, which could assist with economic growth and job creation. But if you look at South Africa, we have a situation where either we are now going to start to succeed, or we're going to become a really failed state in that instance. And the opportunities are there. They are really there. I think the goodwill exists among South Africans. Yes, we have a group of people I would call on the radical left in terms of coming together around MK, EFF. It's almost like a gravitational hole that pulls everybody in there. And what is their approach? Their approach is to defeat the current constitutional dispensation. And it was predictable. 30 years after the agreement in Kudesa, people will come along and say, no. We were not part of that agreement. We were sold out. We want to tear that whole constitutional dispensation down. That's what they all do. And we have to prevent and defeat that. But you can only defeat that if you, on the other hand, you keep the constitutional dispensation intact, and the things you want to achieve can be done within that dispensation. But then you need to bring all the people of reason together in a reasonable way. It can only be done in terms of cooperation, in terms of compromise, in terms of governments of national unity and coalitions. But we still need the leadership of parties to take the step and to understand it's not about me. It's not about my party alone. There's a much bigger picture playing out there. And in order to do so, let's take hands and really do what is necessary to take the country forward. My serious concern at this moment is I don't see that kind of leadership. And that is the problem, and it puts us all in jeopardy at this stage while radical forces are rallying on the side.
Pretty sobering words there from Dr. Corne Mulder. He is the longest-serving parliamentarian in South Africa. He's been in parliament for more than 30 years. We'll hear more on Donald Trump in just a moment. That's to do with the latest broadside that he sent to the world's media this time. We'll take over Gaza, and America will fix what's broken there. There's some quite useful insights from our partners at Bloomberg. But before we get there, I had another fascinating interview today, and that was with Ben Freeth. Ben Freeth is a Zimbabwean. He farmed in Zimbabwe, put everything that he had into the country, bought his farm, actually only went to Zimbabwe during independence, in other words, after the country had a Bush war and the new dispensation came in there, bought the farm and put his whole livelihood in it and then had it taken away. It's a harrowing story, which is up on BizNews TV right now, but I'd like to just pick up on his advice to South Africans over the Expropriation Without Compensation Act that was signed into law by Cyril Ramaphosa in the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, we had the same thing in Zimbabwe, and people said, well, they've put this law in place, but they've assured us that they're not going to use it. But I said, well, they're not going to put the law in place unless they have an intention of using it. And so we need to challenge this law. And people said, no, but that's just going to create friction and conflict and whatever. Anyway, the powers that be decided they're not going to challenge the law. And so that law was used. And in our case, people were just checked into jail, just the army and the police. And they just came around farm to farm, and they just arrested people and put them in jail. and because their farms had, according to the law of Zimbabwe, been acquired. And even though no one had been paid anything or there hadn't been any legal process, as far as the law of Zimbabwe was concerned, they were acquired. And so people were able to be jailed. And, you know, I think that's the thing is where laws are bad, they have to be challenged. And what further needs to be done is that there needs to be a concerted effort to reestablish the SADC tribunal. And, you know, South Africans need to support organizations like AfriForum to help us, because legal expenses obviously are not cheap, to help us to be able to challenge these kinds of things. And hopefully the legal fraternity can come to the party as well and do pro bono work, which is something that we have received on many occasions from lawyers. So, you know, it's very important that if they make laws that are going to be harmful, that we challenge those laws and that we have the foundational principles of the rule of law able to be brought into place if your court system fails you as it failed us. You know, we had our constitutional court invaded actually by the war veterans and our judges chased away and threatened in court process back in 2001. And, you know, these kinds of things can happen in South Africa as well. And so it's so important that we stand by the law. People that don't like the law are a threat to the future and to the children of the future. And we need to stand for the future. But it's not necessarily going to be an easy ride.
Ben Freeth mentioned the SADC tribunal, and this is the part of the story that must be resonating now with South Africans. The SADC group of countries, which represent 400 million people in Southern Africa, established a tribunal so that if laws failed within countries, then you had a court, a higher court than any other court in SADC, and that was where you could take your pleadings to. Ben Freeth did that. He approached the SADC tribunal and won his case that essentially what the Zimbabweans applied, the way they applied the law, their expropriation law, was that if they had put your farm on the list as an acquired farm by the government, no compensation, of course, which is different, it appears, to South Africans, then if you occupied the farm, you were doing so illegally and you could be thrown into jail. So he then took that to the SADC tribunal and won his case with 10 judges all voting unanimously in his favor. Robert Mugabe then got together with Jacob Zuma and they abolished that SADC tribunal. And I guess the question has to be, why has it not been reestablished, especially after Ben Freeth took Zuma to court in South Africa and the South African court said Zuma had no right to assign for the abolition of the SADC tribunal. Okay, it's lots of legal stuff, but my goodness, if you haven't got the rule of law in a country, you really do have nothing. Still with the focus on expropriation without compensation, my colleague Chris Stain spoke today to Dr. Theo de Jager, who highlights the unintended consequences of the EWC Act as it is currently formulated. It allows junior officials who may be little tin pot dictators in their own little municipalities from weaponizing the law. Let's have a watch.
The one is that this act also gives a number of lower ranking tiers of government the power to expropriate. It no longer vests only in national government or the Department of Public Works. Any provincial government or provincial department can also expropriate. Any municipality, any official in a municipality also now will have the power to expropriate. And what will keep a radical politician in a small town from one of the radical parties to try to test the limits of this new expropriation act?
Well, the next thing, the farmer will be expropriated somewhere and we don't know who he or she will be. We only know once it happens all the vaguenesses, all those discount clauses to which there is no numbers or percentage attached to it, it will be determined in that first court case. So that first victim will bear the brunt on behalf of all other farmers. And we are at the moment discussing with a number of other civil society structures in the business space, organized business, in the space of organized employers, to set up a fund to make sure that we will be there and that we can be there to assist that first victim. And in the meantime, we must push. We need everybody's weight in this scrum now. We must push back. We must try to get this act to go back to Parliament and to be changed. We need just and equitable compensation and equal citizenship, very similar to the demands of farmers in Zimbabwe. And we need to make sure that we are safeguarded against the whims of officials, especially on the second and the third tier of government, where the risk is the highest of wild actions within the framework of this act.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Well, the US President Donald Trump has hosted his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, in the White House over the past day or so. And he made quite a stir in the press conference, which concluded the official conversations when saying that the U.S. should take over Gaza.
I do see a long-term ownership position, and I see it bringing great stability to that part of the Middle East and maybe the entire Middle East. And everybody I've spoken to, this was not a decision made lightly. Everybody I've spoken to loves the idea of the United States owning that piece of land, developing and creating thousands of jobs.
He has a different idea, and I think it's worth paying attention to this. We're talking about it. He's exploring it with his people, with his staff. I think it's something that could change history, and it's worthwhile really pursuing this avenue.
President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking at the White House, where the president proposed a U.S. takeover of Gaza. Well, joining us now is retired General Wesley Clark, chairman and CEO at Wesley K. Clark & Associates and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. General, good to have you with us. Perfect timing to have you on our show. Just to put it up there, the U.S. taking over Gaza is actually illegal under international law.
Well, of course, it would have to be given. That's the first thing. But, Haslinda, you know, I did do the work in Bosnia. I was part of the peace delegation. We had a peace agreement there. Look, you have to take what President Trump says seriously. He's the president of the United States. Some people are dismissing it, but here are the challenges he has to face. First of all, even if Israel agrees, who represents the Palestinian people? Does Hamas, are they going to agree? What about the Palestinian Authority? And then you have the terrorists that are in there in addition, like Islamic Jihad. And then where will the people go if they leave Gaza? The Jordanians have said they don't want them. Egyptians have said they don't want them. They've got their own issues with population. That's 1.5, almost 2 million people that have got to go somewhere. Are they going to be in a refugee camp? Who's going to build it? Where is it going to be? And then what are the rules of engagement for the U.S. military if it goes in there? Are we just peace keepers? Are we wait to get shot at? Are we wearing blue helmets? Or are we taking the role of the Israelis? If so, People are not going to like that. And so there are many, many issues that are very difficult here. This is something that has to be worked over many, many months. And there's already considerable opposition to it already voiced in the region. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but also consider it against the very limited resources of the United States military at this point. We have about 440,000 in the army. We're stretched from the Pacific into Europe. And now we're going to put, we have a couple of thousand maybe in the Middle East. Now we're going to put what in Gaza to make sure this works? 20,000, 40,000, and then rotate them. So you have to have three times the number that are deployed. Look, there are many, many, many steps to be analyzed before this could be realized. But I do think it has to be taken seriously. If the president says it, I hope the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and the military leaders will, give it a hard look and come back to the president and say, Mr. President, here's what it takes.
Well, that's General Clark being very kind, but also being fairly skeptical that the idea, the latest idea of Donald Trump's will be enacted. On to the markets now, and here in South Africa, we had a six-month preview from Sasol. It is the trading statement from the company for the period to the end of December, so the interims. Not very good news, I'm afraid, for Sasol shareholders. The headline earnings per share of Sasol are likely to drop quite significantly. They're talking about a 30% decline to around 15 rand a share. This is largely due to the fall in the rand price of oil, down 13%, and a drop in volumes that they've sold. Sasol turns coal and gas into oil, and then its primary revenue source is through the sale of that petrol, rather not oil, petrol into the South African market, petrol and diesel. The chemical side of its business is doing well. That was slightly up, but not enough to offset the decline that was caused by the drop in the rand price of oil. Sasol shares today, though, were up slightly, about 0.5%, at 87 rand a share, but still plumbing 12-month lows. Also out today were some numbers from Sappi. This is the first quarter. Sappi being a company that is listed in the United States as well as in South Africa, it's the world's biggest wood chip paper producer, and it said that in the first quarter of the year, its earnings were up 56%. The official release from Sappi said that it beat expectations. Well, that isn't what the market players thought, and the share price of Sappi was down by 4.2%, about 4.25%. On to the US markets, and last night there were results from Alphabet, which disappointed shareholders. The share price in the pre-market hasn't reopened yet, American shares, but in the pre-market, the shares were down by just under 8%. Reason for that is will be articulated very clearly for us in the clip towards the end of the program. But before we get there, the mining Indaba in Cape Town attracts the top miners in the world, including the man who holds the mantle for being the most important chap in the gold field. He's from Escort in KwaZulu-Natal. His name is Mark Bristow. And Bloomberg, our partners, got hold of Mark to ask him his views on the gold price and what's happening in Mali, where the Malian government have kicked Mark's company, which is Barrick, out of the country because they want more money. And, that big gold mining operation has been suspended. Let's have a look.
What we're seeing is continuation of de-dollarization, fueled by the actions coming out of Washington and the White House. And on top of that, we've got challenges in the UK. Europe is not in good place with the French and the Germans, the leaders of the free world, all in a crisis. and of course Middle East, and conflicts in every continent. So, you know, gold price has got a lot of upside still. I always say the risk is on the upside, and it's very much intact, that trend.
How much further do you think it has to go? Because some people believe potentially we've peaked.
You know, everyone has been saying that. You've seen the equities have been softer than the actual bullion price over 2024. But I don't think so. And certainly, I mean, there's a lot of reason why the gold price shouldn't go down. And
why?
And because it's when you try and if you try and look at what it's going to take for us to get back to normality in the global economy today, it's not an easy task. And I think we've seen, you know, damage to the US dollar as a reputational currency, and gold has taken that place. And I think what we've also seen, and a lot of people, because I'm sure it's your next question, you know, bitcoins and all those are not stores of value. They are trading instruments. So gold has really arrived as the ultimate store of value, and people are buying the physical.
Right.
What we've got to do in the mining industry is catch up with the price of gold.
And Mark, I also want to talk to you about another one of your operations that's in Mali. There's been a lot of focus on what's happening, the discussions between the Malian government and also Barrick. What is the next shoe to drop? Where are we at right now in negotiations?
You know, Jennifer, it's been a very sad time for me. You know, I've been in Mali since it was really re-established as a democracy, and I've worked with many all the governments since 1992, and I think we've you know, Mali's got itself in a position where, you know, it's really trying to shake out some short-term cash out of the industry, and this industry is the very foundation of its economy, and I think we need to, and so communication, to your point, is really important.
Right.
We are in communication, we are working every, and we're making progress, not as fast as I would expect it, but I'm sure everyone is a little cautious. Because that's what happens when you get on the wrong side of everyone.
So you
know?
Haven't agreed to a number or to paying back any of what?
No, we haven't reached an agreement on anything yet, but we are making progress. Okay. And I think that's the positive.
Mark Bristow, who runs Barrick, which is based in North America and one of the top gold companies in the world. Well, we're closing off with those Alphabet results from last night now. The shares dropped sharply, as you saw in the pre-market after those quarterly results, primarily because artificial intelligence was supposed to give the cloud computing industry a push, a boost. And yet, in Alphabet's case, that hasn't happened. Again, let's join up with our partners at Bloomberg.
What was your first reaction to this report?
They missed on cloud, so the growth rate went from 35 to 30, and everyone is expecting AI to help accelerate cloud. We heard from Microsoft, they missed their non-core AI workloads as well. So what's going on? Two of the big three are missing cloud numbers. So that's the first thing. So all eyes will turn to Amazon now. Did they take share? Are they going to see a decel in cloud? And then I go back to just making the numbers, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a big beat. As you know, Alphabet doesn't guide. They don't give us anything. We're flying in the dark as analysts. So they don't give us any guides. So we're all having to guess. And yeah, I think that's a bigger problem we could talk about.
Yeah.
But you know, YouTube and core search, you know, 1 to 2% ahead, nothing exciting. Cloud was 2% light. And then you have CapEx a little bit higher, 14.28 versus our 14.23. So, you know, again, it was a ho-hum, not super exciting. It should have been more exciting given kind of some of the tailwinds, given it's a Q4. And again, they don't guide, so we're all going to be guessing. They don't really give you any color on the call. It's probably one of the worst calls for any color of any tech company we cover. Mm-hmm. So they're unfortunately not going to help anyone on what they see in the pipeline for Q1.
Overall,
not great.
Well, what does this mean, though? Because, I mean, we talk about, at least in past quarters, some of the catch-up that Google was doing with regards to cloud, trying to catch up with obviously the behemoth Amazon and to a certain extent Microsoft. In your view, without necessarily knowing what the company's internal guidance is this progress interrupted or is this progress basically just stalled?
Probably stalled. I'd say they're considered kind of the third call in cloud, right? You have Amazon, number one, 50%+ market share. Microsoft, with their hybrid approach, has a tremendous opportunity and is actually, if you put it in perspective, Microsoft is growing at the same rate, if not faster, in their Azure business, which is their cloud business, as Google, and they're multiple times bigger, right? So this, to me, demonstrates that, again, Microsoft is taking market share. When you look at the growth rate, at their size, is incredible that they're growing at that rate. Mm-hmm. And the street was disappointed. You know, they didn't show bigger acceleration for Microsoft. So what I think you're seeing is two of the three big hyperscalers are now disappointed on cloud. What's Amazon going to say later this week?
And that's a big story. Amazon will be followed very closely. Very interesting here in South Africa, where we do pay a heck of a lot more attention now on what's happening overseas and to the Magnificent Seven companies like Microsoft and Alphabet, which is the holding company of Google, and Amazon coming out later. Of course, Apple as well is one of those, along with Tesla and NVIDIA. We'll look forward to being back in your company tomorrow when Bronwyn Nielsen will be with you. And from me, until the next time, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.